green, spring-wound, indestructible, and only a little bigger than the roll of film it used. They would take off on their bikes from time to time, looking for targets of opportunity, both discovering after a while a common interest in respect for the natural environment. Having seen too much of it napalmed, polluted, defoliated, till the laterite beneath was sun-baked, solid, and useless. Farley had already collected dozens of reels worth of stateside environmental abuse, especially Channel View Estates, which reminded him strangely of jungle clearings he had known. According to Spike, Farley had been out there the same day as Doc, shooting footage of the vigilante raid, and was waiting now to get it back from the lab. Spike himself had been growing obsessed with the El Segundo oil refinery and tanks just up the coast. Even when the wind here cooperated, Gordita was still like living on a houseboat anchored in a tar pit. Everything smelled like crude. Oil spilled from tankers washed up on the beach, black, thick, gooey. Anybody who walked on the beach got it on the bottoms of their feet. There were two schools of thought. Dinas, for example, liked to let it just accumulate till it was thick as huarache soles, thereby saving him the price of a pair of sandals. Others, more fastidious, incorporated regular foot cleaning into their day, like shaving or brushing their teeth. "Don't get me wrong," Spike said the first time Sortilege found him on the porch with a table knife scraping off the soles of his feet. "I love it here in Gordita, mostly 'cause it's your hometown and you love it. But now and then there's just some little fucking detail." "They're destroying the planet," she agreed. "The good news is that, like any living creature, Earth has an immune system, too, and sooner or later she's going to start rejecting agents of disease like the oil industry, and hopefully before we end up like Atlantis and Lemuria." It was the belief of her teacher, Vihai Fairfield, that both empires had sunk into the sea because Earth couldn't accept the levels of toxicity they'd reached. "Vihai's okay," Spike told Doc now, "though he sure does an awful lot of acid." "It helps him see," explained Sortilege. Vihai wasn't just into LSD. Acid was the medium he swam and occasionally surfed in. He got it delivered, possibly by special pipeline, from Laguna Canyon, direct from the labs of the post-Owsley psychedelic mafia, believed in those days to be operating back in there. In the course of systematic daily tripping, he had found a spirit guide named Kamukia, a Lemuro-Hawaiian demigod from the dawn of Pacific history, who centuries ago had been a sacred functionary of the lost continent now lying beneath the Pacific Ocean. "And if anybody can put you in touch with Shasta Fay," Sortilege said, "it's Vihai."
"Come on, Leege. You know I had some weird history with him."
"Well, he thinks you've been trying to avoid him, and he can't understand why."
"Simple. Rule number one of the Doper's Code. Never, ever put nobody..."
"But he told you that was acid."
"No, he told me it was Burgermeister Special Edition."
"Well, that's what that means, Special Edition. It's a phrase he uses."
"You know that. He knows that."
By which point they were out on the esplanade, en route to Vihai's place. Voluntary or whatever, the trip Vihai'd put him on with that magic beer can was one Doc kept hoping he'd forget about with time, but didn't. It had all begun, apparently, some 3 billion years ago on a planet in a binary star system quite a good distance from Earth. Doc's name then was something like Kusakuk, and because of the two suns and the way they rose and set, He worked some very complicated shifts, cleaning up after a lab full of scientist priests who invented things in a gigantic facility which had formerly been a mountain of pure osmium. One day he heard some commotion down a semi-forbidden corridor and went to have a look. Ordinarily sedate and studious personnel were running around in uncontrolled glee. "We did it!" they kept screaming. One of them grabbed Doc, or actually Cussacuck. "Here he is, the perfect subject." Before he knew it, he was signing releases and being costumed in what he would soon learn was a classic hippie outfit of the planet Earth, and led over to a peculiarly shimmering chamber in which a mosaic of Looney Tunes motifs was repeating obsessively away in several dimensions at once, in vividly audible yet unnameable spectral frequencies. The lab people were explaining to him, meanwhile, that they'd just invented intergalactic time travel, and that he was about to be sent across the universe and maybe 3 billion years into the future. Oh, and one other thing, just before throwing the final switch. The universe, it's been, like, expanding, so when you get there, everything else will be the same weight, but bigger, with all the molecules further apart, except you. You'll be the same size and density, meaning you'll be about a foot shorter than everybody else, but much more compact, like solid. "Can I walk through walls?" Cussacuck wanted to know. But by then, space and time as he knew it, not to mention sound, light, and brain waves, were all undergoing these unprecedented changes. And next thing he knew, he was standing on the corner of Dune Crest and Gordita Beach Boulevard, and watching what seemed to be an endless procession of young women in bikinis, some of whom were smiling at him and offering thin cylindrical objects whose oxidation products were apparently meant to be inhaled. As it turned out, he was able to go through drywall construction with little discomfort. Although not having X-ray vision, he did run into some disagreeable moments with wall studs and eventually curtail the practice. His new hyperdensity also allowed him sometimes to deflect simple weapons directed at him with hostile intent, though bullets were another story. And he also learned to avoid those when possible. Slowly, the Gordita Beach of his trip merged with the everyday version, and he began to assume that things were back to normal, except for when, now and then, he'd forget and lean against a wall and suddenly find himself halfway through it and trying to apologize to somebody on the other side. "Well," Sortilege supposed, "many of us do get uncomfortable when we discover some secret aspect to our personality. But it's not like you ended up 3 feet tall with the density of lead."
"Easy for you to say. Try it sometime."
They had arrived at a beach pad with salmon walls and an aqua roof, with a dwarf palm growing out of the sand in front, decorated all over with empty beer cans, among which Doc couldn't help noticing a number of ex-burgies.
"Actually," Doc remembered, "I've got this coupon, buy a case, get one free. Expires midnight tonight. Maybe I better..."
"Hey, it's your ex-old lady, man. I'm just along for the finder's fee."
They were greeted by a person with a shaved head wearing wire-rimmed sunglasses and a green and magenta kimono with some kind of bird motif on it. He was a dedicated old-school longboarder recently back from Oahu, having somehow known in advance about the epic surf that hit the north shore of that island back in December.
"Man, did you miss a big story," he greeted Doc. "You too, man. I'm talking about sets of 50-foot waves that wouldn't quit."
50, huh?
"I'm talking about Charlie Manson getting popped."
They looked at each other.
"On the face of it," Vihai Fairfield said finally, "two separate worlds, each unaware of the other, but they always connect someplace." Manson and the Surge of 69, said Doc. I'd be very surprised if they weren't connected, Vihai said.
That's because you think everything is connected, Sortilege said.
Think? He turned back to Doc, beaming. You're here about your ex-old lady.
What?
You got my message. You just don't know you did.
Oh, sure. Woo-woo telephone and telegraph, I keep forgetting.
Not a very spiritual person, Vihai remarked.
His attitude needs some work, Sortilege said, but for the level he's on, he's okay.
Here, take some of this.
Vihai held out a piece of blotter with something written on it in Chinese, maybe Japanese.
Oh, boy, now what? More through-the-wall sci-fi, right? Groovy. Can't wait.
Not this, said Vihai. This is designed expressly for you.
Sure, like a T-shirt.
Doc popped it in his mouth.
Wait, expressly for me? What's that mean?
But after putting onto his stereo at top volume, Tiny Tim singing The Ice Caps Are Melting from his recent album, which had been somehow fiendishly programmed to repeat indefinitely, Vihai had either left the area or become invisible. At least it wasn't quite as cosmic as the last trip this acid enthusiast had acted as travel agent for. When it began exactly wasn't too clear, but at some point, via some simple, normal transition, Doc found himself in the vividly lit ruin of an ancient city that was, and also wasn't, everyday greater L.A., stretching on for miles, house after house, room after room, every room inhabited. At first he thought he recognized the people he ran into, though he couldn't always put names to them. Everybody living at the beach, for example, Doc and all his neighbors, were and were not refugees from the disaster which had submerged Lemuria thousands of years ago. Seeking areas of land they believed to be safe, they had settled on the coast of California. Somehow, unavoidably, the war in Indochina figured in. The U.S. being located between the two oceans into which Atlantis and Lemuria had disappeared was the middle term in their ancient rivalry, remaining trapped in that position up to the present day, imagining itself to be fighting in Southeast Asia out of free will, but in fact repeating a karmic loop as old as the geography of those oceans, with Nixon, a descendant of Atlantis, just as Ho Chi Minh was of Lemuria, because for tens of thousands of years, all wars in Indochina had really been proxy wars, going back to the previous world, before the U.S. or French Indochina, before the Catholic Church, before the Buddha, before written history, to the moment when three Lemurian holy men landed on those shores, fleeing the terrible inundation which had taken their homeland, bringing with them the stone pillar they had rescued from their temple in Lemuria, and would set up as the foundation of their new life and the heart of their exile. It would become known as the Sacred Stone of Mu, and over the centuries to follow, as invading armies came and went, the stone would be taken away each time for safekeeping to a secret location, to be put up someplace different when the troubles were over. Ever since France began colonizing Indochina, on through the present occupation by the U.S., the sacred stone had remained invisible, withdrawn into its own space. Tiny Tim was still singing the same number, moving through the three-dimensional city labyrinth. Doc noticed after a while that the lower levels seemed a little damp. By the time the water was ankle deep, he began to get the idea. This entire vast structure was sinking. He went up steps to higher and higher levels, but the water level kept rising. Beginning to panic and cursing Vihai for setting him up once again,
He felt, more than saw, the Lemurian spirit guide Kamukiya as a shadow of deep clarity. "We must leave now," said the voice in his mind. They were flying together, close to the tops of the waves of the Pacific. There was dark weather at the horizon. Ahead of them, a white blur began to sharpen and grow, and slowly it resolved into the sails of a top-masted schooner, running along full spread before a fresh breeze. Doc recognized the Golden Fang. "Preserved," Kamukiya silently corrected him. This was no dream ship. Every sail and piece of rigging was doing its work, and Doc could hear the snap of canvas and the creak of timbers. He angled in toward the port quarter of the schooner, and there was Shasta Fay, brought here, it seemed, under some kind of duress, out on deck, alone, gazing back at the way she'd come, the home she'd left. Doc tried calling her name, but of course words out here were only words. "She'll be all right," Kamukiya assured him. "You don't have to worry. That is another thing you must learn. For what you must learn is what I am showing you."
"I'm not sure what that means, man."
Even Doc could feel now how mercilessly, despite the wind and the sails of the moment so clean and direct, this honest old fishing vessel had come to be inhabited, possessed by an ancient and evil energy. How would Shasta be safe in that? "I have brought you this far, but now you must return through your own efforts." The Lemurian was gone, and Doc was left at his negligible altitude above the Pacific to find his way out of a vortex of corroded history, to evade somehow a future that seemed dark whichever way he turned.
"It's okay, Doc."
Sortilege had been calling his name now for a while. They were outside on the beach. It was nighttime. Vihai wasn't there. The ocean lay close by, dark and invisible, except for luminescence where the surf broke stately as the baseline to some great, uncontainable rock and roll classic. From somewhere back in the alleys of Gordita Beach came gusts of doper's merriment.
"Well,
don't say it," warned Sortilege. "Don't say, 'Let me tell you about my trip.'"
"Makes no sense. Like, we were out in this—"
"I can either press your lips closed gently with my finger, or—" She made a fist and positioned it near his face.
"If your guru Vihai did not just set me up."
After about a minute, she said,
"What?"
"Huh? What was I talking about?"
Chapter 8. The bank deposit form Sloan Wolfman had given Doc was from Arbolata Savings and Loan in Ojai. This, according to Aunt Reet, was one of many S&Ls Mickey held a controlling interest in.
"And their customers, how would you describe them?"
"Mostly individual homeowners, what we in the profession refer to as suckers," replied Aunt Reet.
"And the loans? Anything out of the ordinary?"
"Ranchers, local contractors, maybe some Rosicrucians and Theosophists now and then. Oh, and of course there's Chrysgylodon, who've been doing a heap of building and landscaping and tacky but expensive interior design lately." As if his head was a 3D gong just struck by a small hammer, Doc recalled the blurry foreign word in the photo of Sloane he'd seen at her house.
"How do you spell that? And what is it?"
"Got one of their brochures someplace on this desk, down around the Precambrian layer, as I recall. Aha, here. Located in the scenic Ojai Valley, Chrysgylodon Institute, from an ancient Indian word meaning serenity, provides silence, harmony with the earth, and unconditional compassion for those emotionally at risk owing to the unprecedented stressfulness of life in the 60s and 70s.
"Sure sounds like a high-rent loony bin, don't it?"
The pictures don't tell you much. Everything's been shot with grease on the lens, like some girly magazine. There's a phone number here.
Doc copied it, and she added,
"Call your mother, by the way."
Oh, shit, something happened?
You didn't call her for a week and a half is what happened.
Work?
Well, the latest is they think you're a dope dealer now. The impression I get, I should say.
Right. Well, seeing Gilroy's the one with the life, operations manager for whatever, grandkids and acreage and so forth, stands to reason, don't it? I should be the one with the narcs breathing down my neck.
Preaching to the choir, Doc. I wanted out of that place before I could talk. They'd catch me pedaling a mile a minute on my little pink trike, heading out through the beet fields and drag me back screaming. Nothing you can tell me about the San Joaquin kid.
Then again, Elmina says she misses your voice.
I'll call her.
She also agrees with me you should look at that 2-acre piece out in Pacoima.
Not me, man.
Still on the market, Doc. And like we say in the business, get a lot while you're young.
Leo Sportello and Elmina Breeze had met up in 1934 at the world's largest outdoor rummy game, held annually in Ripon. Leo, reaching for one of her discards, said something like,
"Now, you sure you don't want that?"
And as Elmina told it, the minute she looked up from her cards and into his eyes, she was sure of salvation about what she did want. She was still living at home then, student teaching, and Leo had a good job at one of the wineries, known for a fortified product marketed up and down the coast as Midnight Special. Every time Leo so much as put his head in the door, Elmina's father would go into a W.C. Fields routine.
"Ah, the wino's friend, yes."
Leo began to make a point of bringing some over whenever he came to pick up Elmina for a date, and before long his future father-in-law was buying the stuff by the case, using Leo's company discount. The first wine Doc ever drank was Midnight Special, part of Grandpa Breeze's concept of babysitting. Doc was home watching division semifinals between the 76ers and Milwaukee, mainly for Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, whom Doc had admired since he was Lou Alcindor, when right in the middle of a fast break he became aware of a voice down in the street calling his name. For a minute he flashed that it was Aunt Reet, secretly resolved to sell his place out from under him, showing it at this inappropriate hour to some flatland couple, especially selected for their pain-in-the-ass qualities. By the time he got to the window to have a look, he dug how he'd been fooled by a similarity of voices, and it was actually his mother, Elmina, in the street, somehow in deep discussion with downstairs Eddie. She looked up, saw Doc, and started waving cheerfully.
"Larry! Larry!"
Behind her was a double-parked 1969 Oldsmobile, and Doc could dimly make out his father, Leo, leaning out the window, an inexpensive cigar clamped in his teeth, pulsing bright to dim and back again. Doc was now imagining himself at the rail of a long-ago ocean liner sailing out of San Pedro, ideally for Hawaii, but Santa Monica would do, and he waved back,
"Ma! Dad! Come on up!"
He went running around, opening windows and cranking up the electric fan, though the odor of marijuana smoke, having long found its way into the rug, the couch, the velvet painting, was years too late to even worry about.
"Where do I park this?"
Leo hollered up.
Good question.
The kindest thing anybody'd ever call the parking in Gordita Beach was non-linear. The regulations changed unpredictably from one block, often one space, to the next, having been devised secretly by fiendish anarchists to infuriate drivers into one day forming a mob and attacking the offices of town government.
"Be right down," said Doc.
"Will you look at that hair?"
Elmina greeted him.
Soon as I can get to Miramar. By which time she was in his arms, not all that put out at being hugged and kissed in public by a long-haired hippie freak. Hi, Dad. Doc slid into the front seat. There's probably something down on Beachfront Drive. Just hope we don't have to go halfway to Redondo to find it. Meantime, downstairs Eddie was going, Wow, so this is your folks, far out, and so forth.
You boys go park, said Elmina. I'll just hang out with Larry's neighbor here.
Doors open upstairs. Doc, quickly reviewing what he knew of Eddie's rap sheet, including the hearsay. Just don't get in any kitchens with this guy. You should be all right.
That was back in 67, Eddie protested. All those charges got dropped.
My, said Elmina.
Of course, no more than 5 minutes later, having lucked into a spot just down the hill, good at least till midnight, Doc and Leo returned to find Eddie and Elmina in the kitchen, and Eddie just about to open the last box of brownie mix.
Ah, ah, ah,
Doc wagging his finger.
There were beers and half a bag of Cheetos, and Surfside Slick's deli up the hill was open till midnight for whatever they'd be running out of.
Elmina wasted no time in bringing up the subject of Shasta Fay, whom she'd met once and taken to right away.
I always hoped, oh, you know.
Leave the kid be, muttered Leo.
Doc was aware of downstairs Eddie, who'd once upon a time had to listen to it all through his ceiling, throwing him a look.
She had her career, Elmina continued. It's hard, but sometimes you have to let a girl go when her dreams are calling her. There did used to be Hepworths over by Manteca. You know, and a couple of them moved down here during the war to work in the defense plants. She could be related.
If I see her, I'll ask, Doc said. There were footfalls up the back steps, and Scott Oof came in by way of the kitchen. Hi, Uncle Leo, Aunt Elmina. Mom said you'd be driving down.
We missed you at supper, Elmina said.
Had to go see about a gig. You'll be here for a while, right?
Leo and Elmina were staying up on Sepulveda at the Skyhook Lodge, which did a lot of airport business and was populated day and night with the insomniac, the stranded and deserted, not to mention an occasional certified zombie.
Wandering all up and down the halls, said Elmina. Men in business suits, women in evening gowns, people in their underwear or sometimes nothing at all. Toddlers staggering around looking for their parents, drunks, drug addicts, police, ambulance technicians, so many room service carts they get into traffic jams. Who needs to get in the car and go anyplace? The whole city of Los Angeles is right there, 5 minutes from the airport.
How's the television? Downstairs Eddie wanted to know.
The film library's on some of these channels, Elmina said. I swear, there was one on last night I couldn't sleep. After I saw it, I was afraid to sleep. Have you seen Black Narcissus, 1947?
Eddie, who was enrolled in the graduate film program at SC, let out a scream of recognition. He'd been working on his doctoral dissertation, Deadpan to Demonic, Subtextual Use of Eyeliner in the Cinema. And had just, in fact, arrived at the moment in Black Narcissus where Kathleen Byron, as a demented nun, shows up in civilian gear, including eye makeup good for a year's worth of nightmares.
Well, I hope you'll be including some men, Elmina said. All those German silence? Conrad Veidt in Caligari? Klein Rogge in Metropolis?
Complicated, of course, by the demands of orthochromatic film stock.
Oh, boy. Doc went out to search through the kitchen, having dimly recalled an unopened case of beer that might be there. Soon Leo put his head in.
I know it has to be someplace, Doc puzzled out loud.
Maybe you can tell me if this is normal, Leo said. We got a weird phone call at the motel last night. Somebody on the other end starts screaming, At first I figure it's Chinese. I can't understand a word. Finally I can just make out, "We know where you are. Watch your ass." And they hang up.
Doc was having those rectal throbs.
"What name are you guys checked in under?"
"Our usual one." But Leo was blushing.
"Dad, it could be important."
"Okay, but try to understand, it's this habit your mother and I have sort of fallen into, of staying at different motels up and down all 99 on weekends under fake names. We pretend we're married to other people and having an illicit rendezvous. And I won't try to kid you. It's a lot of fun. Like those hippies say, whatever turns you on, right?"
"So the front desk doesn't really have you down as any kind of sportello?" Leo gave him one of those hesitant smiles that fathers use to deflect the disapproval of sons.
"I like to use Frank Chambers. You know, from The Postman Always Rings Twice. Your mother uses Cora Smith, if anybody asks. But for Christ's sake, don't tell her I told you that."
"So, it was a wrong number."
Doc saw the case of beer, out in front of his face all this time. He put some cans in the freezer, hoping he'd remember he'd done this and that nothing would explode like it usually did.
"Well, Dad, I'm really shocked at you two."
He embraced Leo and held it for almost long enough to be embarrassing.
"What's this?" Leo said. "You laughing at us?"
"No, no. I'm laughing 'cause I like to use that same name."
"Huh? You must get that from me."
Later, though, around 3 a.m., 4, one of those desolate hours, Doc had forgotten his feelings of relief and only remembered how scared he'd been. Why had he automatically assumed there was something out there that could find his parents so easily and put them in danger? Mostly in these cases, the answer was, you're being paranoid. But in the business, paranoia was a tool of the trade. It pointed you in directions you might not have seen to go. There were messages from beyond, if not madness, at least a shitload of unkind motivation. And where did that mean this Chinese voice in the middle of the night, whenever that might be at the Skyhook Lodge, was telling him to look? Next morning, waiting for the coffee to percolate, Doc happened to glance out the window and saw Sancho Smilex down in his classic beach town ride, a maroon 289 Mustang with a black vinyl interior and a low, slow throb to its exhaust, trying not to block up the alley.
"Sanch, come on up. Have some coffee."
Sancho took the stairs two at a time and stood panting in the doorway, holding a briefcase.
"Didn't know if you were up." "Me neither. What's happening?"
Sancho had been out all day and night with a posse of federales aboard a garishly over-equipped vessel belonging to the Justice Department, visiting a site previously identified as the spot where the Golden Fang was supposed to have left some kind of lagoon. Divers went down to have a look, and as the light shifted over the ocean, presently were bringing up one Connex after another full of shrink-wrapped bundles of U.S. currency, maybe the same ones Cookie and Joaquin, on behalf of Blondie-san, might still be out after. Except that upon opening the containers, imagine how surprised everybody was to find that, instead of the usual dignitaries, Washington, Lincoln, Franklin, and whoever, all of these bills, no matter which denomination, seemed to have Nixon's face on them. For an instant, a federal joint task force paused to wonder if they might not, after all, the whole boatload of them, be jointly hallucinating. Nixon was staring wildly at something just out of sight, past the edge of the cartouche, almost cringing out of its way, his eyes strangely unfocused, as if he had himself been abusing some novel Asian psychedelic. According to intelligence contacts of Sancho's,
It had been common CIA practice for a while to put Nixon's face on phony North Vietnamese bills as part of a scheme to destabilize the enemy currency by airdropping millions of these fakes during routine bombing raids over the North. But Nixonizing U.S. currency this way was not as easily explained, nor sometimes even appreciated.
What's this? The CIA's done it again. This shit is worthless.
You don't want it? I'll take it.
What are you going to do with it?
Spend a bundle of it before anybody begins to notice.
Some thought it was a plot by Chinese communist pranksters to mess with the U.S. dollar. The engraving work was too exquisite not to have some fiendish Oriental provenance. According to others, it might have been circulating as script for a while now throughout Southeast Asia, and even somehow be negotiable stateside.
And let's not forget its value on the collector's market. Bit too weird for me, I'm afraid.
And dig, said Sancho later to Doc. The law says that before you can get your picture on U.S. currency, you have to be dead. So, in any universe where this stuff is legal tender, Nixon would have to be dead, right? So, what I think it is it sympathetic magic by somebody who wants to see Nixon among the departed.
That sure narrows it down, Sanch. Can I have some of this?
Hey, take whatever. Go on a shopping spree. See these shoes I've got on? Remember those white loafers that Dr. No wears in Dr. No 1962?
Yes, dig it. Same, identical ones.
Bought them on Hollywood Boulevard with some of these Nixon 20s. Nobody examined it. Nothing. It's amazing. Hey, my soap's almost on. Do you, mind?
He headed for the tube without delay.
Sancho was a devoted viewer of the daytime drama, The Way to His Heart. This week, as he updated Doc during lulls, Heather has just confided to Iris her suspicions about the meatloaf, including Julian's role in switching the contents of the Tabasco bottle. Iris isn't too surprised, of course, having for the duration of her own marriage to Julian taken turns in the kitchen, so that there remain between these bickering exes literally hundreds of culinary scores yet to be settled. Meanwhile, Vicky and Stephen are still discussing who still owes who $5 from a pizza delivery weeks ago, in which the dog, Eugene, somehow figures as a key element. Doc was in the toilet pissing during a commercial break when he heard Sancho screaming at the television set. He got back to find his attorney just withdrawing his nose from the screen.
Everything cool?
Ah, collapsing on the couch. Charlie the fucking tuna, man.
What?
It's all supposed to be so innocent, upwardly mobile snob, designer shades, beret, so desperate to show he's got good taste, except he's also dyslexic, so he gets good taste mixed up with taste good. But it's worse than that, far, far worse. Charlie really has this, like, obsessive death wish. Yes, he wants to be caught, processed, put in a can, not just any can, you dig. It has to be a star-kissed, suicidal brand loyalty, man. Deep parable of consumer capitalism. They won't be happy with anything less than drift-netting us all, chopping us up and stacking us on the shelves of supermarket America. And subconsciously, the horrible thing is we want them to do it.
Sanch, wow, that's...
It's been on my mind. And another thing, why is there chicken of the sea, but no tuna of the farm?
Doc actually beginning to think about this.
And don't forget, Sancho went on to remind him darkly, that Charles Manson and the Viet Cong are also named Charlie.
When the show was over, Sancho said,
So, how you doing, Doc? Gonna be arrested again or anything?
With Bigfoot on my tail now, I could be calling you any minute.
Oh, I almost forgot. The Golden Fang?
Seems there was an Ocean Marine insurance policy taken out on her just before she singled up all lines, covering this one voyage only, the one your ex-old lady's supposed to be on. And the beneficiary is listed as Golden Fang Enterprises of Beverly Hills. If the boat sinks, they collect a lot of money?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. What if it was a deliberate insurance hustle? Maybe Shasta could still get ashore in time, onto some island where maybe even now she'd be pulling small, perfect fish out of the lagoon and cooking them with mangoes and hot peppers and shredded coconut. Maybe she was sleeping out on the beach and looking at stars nobody here under the smog-lit L.A. sky even knew existed. Maybe she was learning to sail island to island on an outrigger canoe, to read the currents and the winds and how to sense magnetic fields like a bird. Maybe the Golden Fang had sailed onto its fate, gathering those who hadn't found their way to shore deeper into whatever complications of evil, indifference, abuse, despair they needed to become even more themselves, whoever they were. Maybe Shasta had escaped all that. Maybe she was safe. That evening over at Penny's place, Doc fell asleep on her couch in front of the day's sports highlights, and when he woke, sometime well after dark, a face, which turned out to be Nixon's, was on the tube going,
"There are always the whiners and complainers who'll say, 'This is fascism.' Well, fellow Americans, if it's fascism for freedom, I can dig it."
Tumultuous applause from a huge room full of supporters, some of them holding banners with the same phrase professionally lettered on them. Doc sat up, blinking, groping around in the tube light for his stash, finding half a joint and lighting up. What struck him was that Nixon right now had the exact freaked-out expression on his face that he did on the fake $20 bills Doc had gotten from Sancho. He took one out of his wallet now and consulted it, just to be sure. Yep, the two Nixons looked just like the photos of each other.
"Let's see," Doc inhaled and considered.
This same Nixon face here, live on the screen, had somehow already been put into circulation, months ago, on millions, maybe billions, in false currency. How could this be? Unless, sure, time travel, of course, some CIA engraver in some top security workshop far away was busy right now copying this image off his own screen and then would later somehow go slip his copy into a covert special mailbox, which would have to be located close to a power company substation so they could bootleg the power they needed, raising everybody else's rates to send information time-traveling back into the past. In fact, there might even be time-warp insurance you could buy in case these messages went astray among the unknown energy surges out there in the vastness of time.
"I knew I smelled something in here. Lucky for you, I don't go into work tomorrow." Penny, squinting and bare-legged in one of Doc's pearls-before-swine T-shirts.
"This joint woke you up? Sorry, Pen. Here." Offering what was by now more a friendly gesture than a real roach.
"No, all that screaming did. What are you watching? Sounds like yet another Hitler documentary."
"Nixon, I think it's happening live right now someplace in L.A.
"Could be the Century Plaza,"
which was presently confirmed by the news folks covering the event. Nixon had indeed dropped in, as if on a whim, at the palatial West Side Hotel to address a rally of GOP activists who called themselves Vigilant California. In cutaways to individuals in the audience, some seemed a little out of control, like you'd expect to find at gatherings like this, but others were less demonstrative, and, to Doc at least, scarier.
Strategically posted among the crowd wearing identical suits and ties, you'd have to call on the unhip side, none of them seemed to be paying much attention to Nixon himself.
I don't think they're Secret Service, Penny sliding over next to Doc on the sofa. Not cute enough to begin with, more like private sector.
They're waiting for something. Ha, look, here we go.
As if linked by ESP, the robot operatives had pivoted as one and begun to converge on a member of the audience, long-haired, wild-eyed, dressed in matching psychedelic Nehru shirt and bell-bottoms, who was now screaming,
"Hey, Nixon! Hey, Tricky Dick! Fuck you! And you know what? Hey, fuck Spiro, too! Fuck everybody in the first fucking family! Fuck the dog! Hey! Anybody know the dog's name? Whatever! Fuck the dog, too! Fuck all of you!"
And began to laugh insanely as he was seized and dragged away through the crowd, many of them glaring, snarling, and foaming at the mouth in disapproval.
"Better get him to a hippie drug clinic," suggested Nixon humorously.
"Giving revolutionary youth a bad name," it seemed to Doc, who was rolling another joint.
"Not to mention raising some First Amendment issues." Penny leaning up close to the screen. "Strange, though."
"Really? Looks like typical Republicans to me."
"No, I mean, there's the close-up. That's no hippie. Look at him. It's Chucky."
Or to put it another way, Doc now became aware with a jolt it was also Coy Harlingen. It took him maybe half a lungful of pot smoke to decide against sharing this with Penny.
"Friend of yours?" he inquired disingenuously.
"Everybody knows him. When he's not hanging out at the Hall of Justice, he's at the Glass House." "A snitch?"
"Informant, please. He works mostly for the Red Squad and the P. Diddy's."
"Who?"
"Public Disorder Intelligence Division. Never heard of him, huh?"
"And why's he yelling at Nixon like that?"
"Geez, Doc. At this rate, they're going to pull your paranoia card. Even a PI can't be that naive."
"Well, his outfit maybe is a little over-coordinated, but that don't mean there's any setup."
She sighed didactically. "But now that he's been all over the TV, he has instant and wide credibility. The police can infiltrate him into any group they want."
"You guys been watching that Mod Squad again. Gives you all these cold-ass ideas. Hey, did I tell you Bigfoot offered me a job the other day?"
"Astute of Bigfoot, as always. He must have detected in your character some special gift for betrayal."
"Come on, Penny. She was 16, she was dealing, I was only trying to steer her away from a life of crime. How long are you gonna—"
"Goodness, I don't know why you always get so defensive about it, Doc. There's no reason to feel guilty. Is there?"
"Great. Just what I want to do. Discuss guilt with a deputy DA."
"Was identified," the TV set announced, while Penny reached to turn up the volume, "as Rick Doppel, an unemployed student dropout from UCLA.
"I don't think so," Penny muttered. "It's that Chucky."
"And dang," Doc added silently, "if it ain't a resurrected tenor sax player, too."
Chapter 9. Deciding on a professional look, Doc pulled his hair back in a tight ponytail, securing it with a leather clip he only remembered later Shasta had given him, and put a black vintage fedora on top of that, then slung a tape machine over his shoulder. In the mirror, he looked plausible enough. He was headed up to Topanga that afternoon to visit the boards, pretending to be a music reporter for an underground fan magazine called Stone Turntable. Dinas was along, posing as his photographer,
wearing a t-shirt with the familiar detail from Michelangelo's fresco, The Creation of Adam, in which God is extending his hand to atoms, and they're just about to touch. Except in this version, God is passing a lit joint. All the way up to Topanga, the radio cranked out a super surfing marathon, all commercial-free, which seemed peculiar until Doc realized that nobody who would sit through this music teacher's nightmare of doubled-up blues lines, moronic one-chord tunes, and desperate vocal effects could possibly belong to any consumer demographic known to the ad business. From this display of white eccentric binge behavior, only once in a while, mercifully, would there be a departure. Pipeline and Surfin' Bird by the Trashmen, and Bamboo by Johnny and the Hurricanes, singles by Eddie and the Showmen, the Bel Airs, the Hollywood Saxons, and the Olympics, souvenirs out of a childhood Doc had never much felt he wanted to escape from. "When are they going to play Tequila?" Dinas kept wondering, till just as they were pulling up the drive of the board's rented mansion, on it came. The Spanish modality and flamencoid roll strokes of the surfer's sworn enemy, the lowrider. "Tequila!" screamed Dinas as they slid into the last parking space. The house had once belonged to half of a much-loved hillbilly act of the 40s, and currently the boards were renting the place from a bass player turned record company executive, which trend watchers took as further evidence of the end of Hollywood, if not the world as they had known it. Like girls at Hawaiian airports, a couple of house groupies named Bodie and Zinnia came forward with lays, or actually love beads, and put them around Doc's and Dinas's necks, then led them off on a tour of the place, looking at which a less tolerant person might think right away, "Wow, this is what happens when people make too much money in too short a time." But Doc figured it depended on your idea of excess. Over the years, business had obliged him to visit a stately L.A. home or two, and soon he noticed how little sense of what was hip the very well-fixed were able to exhibit, and that, roughly proportional to wealth accumulated, the condition only grew worse. The boards had so far managed to escape serious impairment, though Doc had his doubts about the coffee tables made from antique Hawaiian surfboards, until he saw that all you had to do was unscrew the legs to get back to a rideable plank. Thanks to ingenious porte-cochere arrangements, many of the closets here were not just walk-in but drive-through, full of costumes from past and future worlds, many obtained in Culver City at the MGM Studios' historic sell-off of assets a few months back. Catered meals for 20 or 30 got trucked up here every day from Jurgensen's in Beverly Hills. There was a dope-smoking room with a huge 3D reproduction in fiberglass of Hokusai's famous Great Wave off Kanagawa, arching wall to ceiling to opposite wall, creating a foam-shadowed hideaway beneath the eternally suspended monster, though now and then this would tend to freak a visitor into declining his hit whenever a joint came around, which was fine with the boards, who were still at an arrested stage from back in their surf punk days when every crumb of dope counted, and as greedy on the subject as ever. Outside on a terrace with a view across the canyon, long-haired, short-skirted cuties drifted around in the sunlight tending the marijuana plants, or wheeling huge trays of things to eat, drink, and smoke. Dogs came and went, some reasonably calm, others obsessive-compulsive, bringing you back the otherwise ordinary rock you had been throwing farther and farther away each time for the last half hour. "It's his trip, man." And now and then one fallen afoul of that breed of human that finds amusement in feeding a dog LSD and watching what happens. Doc was reminded for the uncountableth time that for every band like this one, there were 100 or 1,000 others, like his cousin's band Beer,
doomed to scuffle in obscurity, energized by a faith in the imperishability of rock and roll, running on dope and nerve, brother and sisterhood, and good spirits. The boards, though keeping their voicing, the traditional two guitars, bass, and drums, plus a horn section, had changed personnel so often that only meticulous music historians had any kind of handle on who was or had been who anymore. Which didn't matter, because by now the band had evolved into pretty much a brand name, years and changes away from the tough little grommets, all related by blood or marriage, who used to stomp as a cadre barefoot into Cantor's Delicatessen on Fairfax and spend all night eating bagels, hanging out, and trying not to trigger any rock star bodyguards into some kind of episode. When at length the once hippie-friendly eatery, growing concerned about possible lawsuits and insurance costs, started putting up signs saying shoes required, the boards all went down to a tattoo parlor in Long Beach and got sandal straps tattooed on their feet and ankles, which fooled the managerial level for a while. And by then, the band had moved on anyway, to fancier places farther west. But there were a couple of years when you could always tell who the original members of the band were by those ink sandals. For a week or so now, the board's house guests had included Spotted Dick, a visiting British band who were getting some local airplay on those stations where the pulse was less hectic, being themselves often so laid back that people had been known to call the ambulance, mistaking the band's idea of a general pause for some kind of collective seizure. Today they were wearing wide whale corduroy suits in a strangely luminous brownish gold, and sporting precision geometric haircuts from Cohen's Beauty and Barbershop in East London, where Vidal Sassoon had once apprenticed, and where every week the lads were piled onto a small bus, given their weekly cannabis allowance, and brought out to sit in a row, giggling over back issues of Tatler and Queen, and getting scissor-cut, asymmetric bobs. Last week, in fact, the lead vocalist had decided to change his name, legally, to Asymmetric Bob, after his bathroom mirror revealed to him, 3 hours into a mushroom experiment, that there were actually two distinct sides to his face, expressing two violently different personalities.
"They've got a tube in every room," Dinas reported excitedly. "And these zapper units you can change the channel with and not even have to leave the couch."
Doc had a look. These control boxes, recently invented and found only in upscale homes, were large and crude, as if sharing design origins with Soviet sound equipment. Operating them required a forceful touch, and sometimes both hands through which you could feel them buzzing, because they used high-frequency sound waves. This tended to drive most of the house dogs here crazy, except for Myrna, a wirehair who, being older and a little hard of hearing, was able to lie patiently through all sorts of programming, waiting for a dog food commercial to come on, which, because of some strange dog ESP, she knew was due a minute before it actually showed up on the screen. When it was over, she would turn her head to any humans in the vicinity and nod emphatically. At first, people thought this meant she wanted dinner, or at least a snack. But it seemed to be more of a social act along the lines of, "Something, huh?" At the moment, she was lying in an unlit room of uncertain size, which smelled of pot smoke and patchouli oil, watching dark shadows along with selected boards and Spotted Dick personnel, plus those members of the entourage who were not elsewhere in the house running their ass off indulging band whims that required deep-frying Hostess Twinkies, ironing each other's hair on the ironing board to maintain some muse image, and going through fan magazines with X-Acto knives and cutting out all references to competing surf acts. This was around the point in the Collins family saga when the storyline had begun to get heavily into something called
parallel time, which was confounding the viewing audience nationwide. Even those who remained with their wits about them, although many dopers found no problem at all in following it. It seemed basically to mean that the same actors were playing two different roles, but if you'd gotten absorbed enough, you tended to forget